Well, before I get started, I would like to introduce my wife. We've been married almost, well, it'll be 2 years in August. So, Melissa, would you please stand? I'm telling you what, farmersonly.com was really good to us. It was really, no, that's not how we met. It's a great story, how God put us together after a lot of things in our lives. And so someday maybe I'll tell that story. In 1966, my dad retired from the military, and we were stationed in Fort Lewis, Washington, just outside of the Tacoma, Washington area, and he decided to move our family to the great state of Georgia. And so you can insert all your Georgia jokes at this point. The high school that I grew up in, one of the great tragedies was a discontinued driver's education when the donkey died. when the library burned down, the great tragedy was five of the books had not been colored in yet. I mean, I know all the jokes, okay? You know, how do you get a University of Georgia graduate off your front porch? Pay for the pizza. Okay, I realize that. Okay, now, but the time that I was growing up in Georgia, in the educational system, and that's where I, you know, my formative years were, I was there from grade 2nd through 12. In Georgia, there was no such thing as middle school or junior high at that time. And so the way things worked is you went to elementary school from kindergarten through 7th grade. And then after 7th grade, you went to high school from 8th through 12th. And so you just kind of were thrown in with the big kids as soon as you got out of elementary school. And so I left Spalding Elementary School. And because of the districting in our area, only a few of us went to the same high school. Almost everybody that finished up at my school, my elementary school, all went to North Springs High School. About three or four of us ended up going to Sandy Springs High School. So I go to this new high school, and I'm trying my best to fit in. And like many kids who get into that kind of situation, I sort of started scouring about thinking, how do I, you know, kind of get in with whatever crowd? And so I thought that the very best thing for me to do was to play eighth grade football. Now, there were two things that were not in my favor in this decision. The first thing was I had never played organized football. The second was, obviously, I had never looked at a full-length mirror. Because in eighth grade, I looked like that. Isn't he adorable? And evidently, every mirror that I ever saw just showed that much. And I must have just figured from the shoulders down, I was some kind of stud athlete. No, I was not. I was about 5'2", roughly 100 pounds, but I still went out for football because I had a belief that I was going to be the next O.J. Simpson. O.J. happened to be a member of the Buffalo Bills at the time. That was before he was a spokesman for Hertz and then a jailed criminal. and as it turned out, that the one and only requirement for making the eighth grade football team was to have a pulse. So I qualified, and so I made it onto the eighth grade football with this great dream of being a star running back. Well, the very first day of organization there, my dream began to die because they lined us up by size, and they chose the two biggest guys to be the quarterback and the running back. And they just kept moving down, giving out positions, and I ended up way down at the other end of this thing, and they told me that I was going to be a left guard, which I had no idea what that was. And then they told me that I would be a weak side linebacker, I think with an, you know, kind of an emphasis on weak. And so that was my job. But I remained, you know, believing that, you know, the coaches were going to see me and I was going to, you know, impress them and I was going to be a running back. But the dream finally died completely the day that they handed out jerseys. They gave me my jersey and my jersey was number 66. And I could not think of any running backs anywhere with that number. And the jersey on me was so big that when I tucked it in, you could not see the bottom part of the six, so it just looked like double parentheses. And I was pretty sure in the Hall of Fame, there is nobody, make him welcome, double parentheses, Paul, good night. So the dream was really, you know, not going so well. But the first couple of games was really a lot of fun because I was, in fact, a weak side linebacker. They abandoned the idea of putting me on the offensive line. And in the weak side linebacker, if you're not familiar with football, most teams, when they run to the strong side. So you put your better people on strong side to be able to make plays. And as a weak side linebacker, what I would do is I would watch the tackle get made, and then I would just jump on the pile. And so it was great. I mean, I was actually getting my jersey dirty. I mean, it was really good, you know. And so we got to about the third game of the season, and we were playing Milton High School. Milton High School was north of where we were, and we referred to them as the country boys. If you were to go to Milton today, it's a very suburb area. But back then, it was the country boys. You know, some of these eighth graders, I believe, drove to the game. I think, you know, eighth grade was perhaps the best 5 years of their life, that kind of thing. And so they get off the bus, and many, they're already shaving, and most of us have not hit puberty at this point, you know. And so we're out there on the field, and they have a running back, number 44, and evidently their coach noticed that, hey, double parentheses looks kind of small. Why don't we run that way? And so the first play from scrimmage, the hole opens up. Number 44 comes through there as big as a truck, and I do just as I was trained. I plant my feet, and I plant my helmet between the 4 and the 4 on that guy's chest. And there were two hits. He hit me, and I hit the ground. That guy ran me right over. I mean, like, boom, like this. And so they gained about 10 yards, and their coach has figured out the game plan. The next play, same thing. He hits me so hard. When I get up, my helmet is now sideways. I'm looking out the ear hole of the thing. And the coach is over on the side. Coach Say, who chewed a lot of tobacco. And so you could not really understand what he said. And nobody wanted to stand near him because your uniform got all these brown spots on it. You know, but all I could hear was, good night. Good night. And all the guys, he's calling your name. So I run to the side. And I did not get back into the game that day. As a matter of fact, I did not get back into the next game or the next game after that. I spent a lot of time guarding that water over on the sideline. And so I was getting frustrated because I was going to all the practices. I was doing all the things that you're supposed to do to be an eligible member of this People with Pulses. And I'm not getting in. And so I began thinking of this thing like, I'm just not doing this anymore. This is not what I signed up for. And so I was going to go to the coach, though, and I was going to kind of do this, you know, play me or trade me kind of speech that I had for him, you know. And I walk into his office, and in my mind, I was saying, now, coach, like this. But what came out was, coach, like this. And I made up some lame excuse about my grades, like something I would have ever cared about, that my grades were not doing well, and I was going to have to quit the team. And so I ended up quitting the eighth grade football team of Sandy Springs High School. It's interesting how that decision to quit and following through with the decision to quit opened up a new world for me where staying with things became a lot harder. It became a lot easier for me to just bag it if it started to get rough, or to even not consider it if it started to get rough. And so that idea of commitment for me became something very difficult. We live in a day and time where that value of staying with something tends not to be there. My grandfather worked for the B&O, the Baltimore, Ohio Railroad, for his entire work career. He started there as a young man. He finished as an older man and retired from there. That does not happen so much these days. We tend to be more of a society that's always looking for the next thing, kind of the whole greener pasture syndrome that many of us have. And in my world as a marriage counselor, and that being my main role here at Reston Bible Church, unfortunately, I see that same thing playing out often within our church, but it's happening all across America. And I'm not just talking about divorce rate. Divorce rate in America is over 50%. For people who would say that they are evangelical believers, the divorce rate is probably something around 37%, which is an incredibly high number. But I'm not talking about just the idea of divorce rate. I'm talking about couples who've settled to live as functional roommates, where they've allowed their relationship, in essence, they're still there. They show up, you know, all the time, but they're living in their own swimming lanes, and they have very little crossover in their life, and many of their conversations just seem like calendar meetings, and their deepest conversations are about their children. And I find over and over that that's the kind of commitment level that starts to happen over time in many marriages. And so this evening, what I would like to do is walk us through some I will statements. I have five I will statements that I want us to go through tonight. And I believe that in your marriage and in my marriage, if we will consistently choose these five things, it will keep a vibrancy in our relationship. And none of them involve Viagra, okay? We're talking about the very, very practical here. You know, every day we make choices driven by our will. Melissa will tell you that every morning I wake up and I choose to get coffee. And you may say, why? If you have to ask why, I don't even want to know you, all right? You know, now, Melissa chooses not to drink coffee because she doesn't like coffee. And as a matter of fact, when we were dating, that was the only hitch there for me, was like, whoa, she doesn't drink coffee. But then the selfish, practical Paul kicked in, like, that's more for me. So, you know, that was thankfully, I choose other things like showering and brushing my teeth. I do those every few weeks. You know, every day we are making countless choices, and somehow those choices are functioning within the sovereign will of God. It was A.W. Tozer who gave the kind of the illustration to try to marry these two things of God's sovereignty and my responsibility or my choices that I'm making. And his illustration was an ocean liner leaving from New York headed to Liverpool. It's a predetermined route, a predetermined time that it will get there. That is the sovereign will of God. It will happen. But on the ship, people are moving from deck to deck, and they're making choices about food and shuffleboard and all the other things that can happen on an ocean liner. And so they're making choices, but God's sovereign will is still being played out. And so in our choices, it's within God's plan, but he's allowing certain things that we would choose. And again, I want to come back to I will. I will make some choices in our relationship in a consistent way to help us function in a great relationship. So here's the first one. I will love you. Now that one seems really, really obvious. It seems so obvious that perhaps you wouldn't even choose to put that one up there. Is love a feeling or is love a choice? Yes, sort of. When most of you began your relationship, the first thing that you encountered along the way that started to have the whole feeling concept attached to it is what is typically referred to as infatuation. And when they do studies on the brain, they say that infatuation is fueled by a cocktail of chemicals that are taking place inside your head. And the experts don't necessarily agree completely on this, but they say that the timetable that infatuation can be sustained is roughly 11 months to 2 years. And 2 years is only because of extenuating circumstances when people perhaps are doing like long distance relationships. And so the stage of infatuation cannot be maintained throughout a relationship. Our brains just can't do that. But there is still feelings that are attached to the relationship. It's one of the things that we enjoy in marriage is that there is this thing when I see her, she sees me, there's hopefully some feeling attached to it. But the reality is, for a relationship to be sustained, love has to be a choice. Love has to be something that I day in and day out choose with my spouse. In Ephesians 5, verse 25, it says this, husbands, love your wives. It's a command. God gives a directive, just like you shall love the Lord God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. He doesn't say when you feel it. He just gives the directive, you will love. To husbands, again, it's not like if you feel it or if you think she's worthy or whatever it is, it's just a directive. Husband, love your wives. If you get later on in the chapter, it's going to say to the wives to make sure that they respect their husbands. But there's still a love dynamic that's taking place in the home, and love will always be a choice. You've probably heard this before. There's actually four Greek words for love, but there's three primarily that we reference. The first one, the Greek word is phileo, which from that we get the Greek phileo fish. Phileo is like brotherly love. Philadelphia, the city of a very misnamed city, the city of brotherly love. Phileo is companionship or brotherly love. The next one is eros, which is erotic, kind of the passionate part of what love could be. And then the third one that's mainly used of God or is used of God is agape. And agape love is an unconditional, sacrificial love. It has this passion for the well-being of others. And so when it says, husbands, love your wives, that word love is agape. And so it's painting a picture of choice about I will love you in a sacrificial way. I will love you in a very giving, serving kind of way. And so then it naturally flows into the rest of the verse where it's going to say this, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. That the choice of love has an act out part of and I'm going to be giving. I'm going to choose that with you. And so that's our first one. Love is a choice. So hopefully you're writing that down. The next one is this. I will protect our marriage. I will protect our marriage. There are many couples, as I look around this room, you have gone through pre-marriage counseling with me. And in pre-marriage counseling, in one of our conversations, I always bring up the idea of being proactive about putting a box or a hedge around your marriage that both of you say, we don't go outside of this box. I have discovered that couples have reactive conversations about this, but rarely do they have proactive conversations about what is the box we put around our marriage and both of us agree we don't go outside of this. The reactive conversation is the guy comes back from a business trip in New York and he says to his wife, yeah, while we were in New York, Aaron and I went sightseeing. And she says, is that like girl Aaron or is that like guy Aaron? And you know, Aaron, you met her at the Christmas party. You went with Aaron sightseeing? You don't trust me? And they're having that kind of conversation and they've not even thought through what's wise for our relationship. Again, what is the box that we choose to put around our marriage in a very proactive way that says we don't go outside of that? And not every marriage is identical. I recognize that. There can be a lot of circumstances that contribute to that conversation, but my encouragement is that you have the conversation. Years and years ago, when I was the dean of students at a Bible college, I was in my early 30s, and there was a lot of young women on campus. One of the choices my first wife, Leah, and I made was that I would never take a young woman for a ride in my car. As a matter of fact, I would not take any woman for a ride in my car by myself unless she was 90. I think that was the standard. Well, simply making that choice for us, whenever I was in that circumstance, I already knew what I was going to do because we talked about it. We'd had a conversation about, for us, we don't think that's a good idea. And so if somebody said, can you give this person a ride? I already knew that that wasn't going to happen. And so the idea of having the proactive conversation helped in setting the boundaries. And so I encourage you to think that through. You know, for all of us, we believe in preventive maintenance. Most people change the oil in their cars. They change out the filter on their HVAC system. They go to dental checkups to make sure their teeth aren't falling out. They tell their kids not to run into the street before they do it rather than after they do it. We typically think in terms of preventive and preemptive conversations in many situations. And in marriage, I've just discovered that that time, many people have just not even thought about having those kind of conversations. So that's sort of on the negative side of protecting your marriage. But let me give you something really practical on the positive side that I believe contributes to a protective type thing, sort of a kind of the nuance of how we continue to feel good about things, this thing. And it has to do with what I refer to as third-party praise. And let me explain what I mean by that. Third-party praise is that when my spouse hears from somebody else something I've bragged about, related to her. That's third-party praise. Sometime back, I was having lunch with Milt Johnson. Milt Johnson is the senior pastor at Chantilly Bible Church. We've been friends for a long, long time. We have lunch together almost every month. We're at this lunch, and he had just been meeting with Mike Minner, and he proceeded to tell me something that Mike had told him about what he appreciates about me. This was before I shot that video about him, but... Well, to know that Mike Minter was telling a mutual friend of ours something about me that he appreciated. Now, Mike has told me many things over the 24-plus years that we've worked together. But to hear that Mike told it to somebody else meant a whole lot. And the place that I would encourage us to do in our relationships is to make sure that we are telling our family about our spouse, especially our parents. You know, there's an old saying that says, behind every successful man is an amazed mother-in-law. some of you are like, oh, I think I know that. Again, there's something about your choosing with your family to brag on your spouse. Many people make the horrible mistake of when they're struggling, they've had an argument with their spouse, they go to their parents and they tell their parents about it. And I always counsel not to do that. Unless there's some kind of danger involved in the circumstance. Because of this, you and your spouse will figure that thing out more than likely, but your parents will never have the opportunity to. because the issue wasn't with them. And so they will live with something that they feel against your spouse. And so, but on the positive, when you choose to invest in your spouse by telling other people what you appreciate about them, it's a huge thing. Think about it again on the negative. If you were to hear something your spouse said negatively about you to somebody else, it would destroy you. It would just tear you down. But we have the opportunity to invest in each other. And so one of the ways that we proactively protect our marriage is choosing third-party praise, making sure that other people, our children, know that we appreciate their mom, we appreciate their dad. Those kinds of things contribute to that. So that's the second one. I will protect my marriage. The next one is this, and we're going to spend a little more time with this one. I will accept your flaws. I will accept your flaws. It's a funny thing about us. We tend to be pretty forgiving of our own flaws, but generally we're pretty much expect perfection out of everybody else. And we're pretty much willing to drill other people for their imperfections because it's just, there's just something in us that just likes to point that out. You know, guys, you've probably heard me say this. In marriage counseling, the number one complaint I hear from women is that they feel like their husbands do not hear them. But ladies, the number one complaint I hear from men in marriage counseling is, no matter what I do, it will never be good enough. It will never be good enough. I hear that one more than anything else. And what it's saying is that he's feeling like there's a standard of perfection that I can't meet. And typically it says, I'm sort of even at the point of kind of giving up. And that idea of accepting each other's flaws is not just overlooking things. I mean, we're responsible for things. But look at James chapter 3, verse 2. It says, for we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is perfect man, able to bridle the whole body. James is saying a very simple thing. We all stumble in many things. The word all in the Greek is an interesting word. It means all. And so it says, we all stumble in many things. And then he's specifically talking about our speech, that we would try to bridle that and bring that in because it makes us a perfect man. And what it means by that is a mature man. But that idea is, we all stumble in many ways. You married a flawed person, and so did I. That's just how it works. Melissa understands I'm flawed. You know, one of the things that I believe is so important in marriage is the idea of safety, is that with each other, we're safe. And what I mean by that is with each other, we can just talk. The real me can come out, and I can tell you the real me, and I don't have to put some veneer around me with you because you really do accept me for who I am. If I believe that you expect me to be perfect, then I will never have a close relationship with you. If I believe that expectation is perfection, I will not give you all of me because you're not safe. Psychologists Henry Cloud and John Townsend define safe people this way. The ability to connect with us by being emotionally present with us, a posture of gracious acceptance toward us, authenticity and mutual sharing of truth with us. Author Heather Nelson says that when vulnerability is met with empathy, then safety's achieved. When with you, I can be vulnerable and I know that will be met with empathy and understanding, then I will be safe and I will tell you my heart. But if I believe that won't be there, you will not get me because I will not give you all of me. And if I don't feel accepted by you, then I will feel shame. And shame always sends me into hiding. It started in the garden. Shame will always send me into hiding. So if you shame me, if you don't accept me, then I'm going to hide from you. It's just the way we are. And nobody wants his or her flaws to be exposed. And we go to great lengths to appear competent. A few weeks back, it was my turn to provide the staff breakfast for our staff at Reston Bible Church. Our staff, I believe, would tell you that's the day all of us hate the most, because there's this pressure to make sure you come through with the right food. And so it was my turn. And so thankfully, Patty Demon was so kind to send me this thing that tells me where you can order things from. And so it gave me three options. We could do Joe's Cafe, Anita's, or we could do Chick-fil-A. She told us the amounts, you know, the kinds of things we could order. She made it very simple for me. And so I look at this list and I decide, we haven't had Anita's in a while. I like Anita's. Let's go with me. And so I call Anita's, and I begin to put in my order for whatever, however many burritos it was going to be. I think it was like 30 or 35 of them. And so, but it was an unusual conversation because I just wasn't connecting with this guy because he keeps saying, okay, well, we don't really make ones like that. And I'm thinking, this is Anita's. You always make things. I've eaten these things 100 times, but he's, I'm thinking, you know, he knows more than me. And so he's, okay, let me try to put this in the computer. And I'm thinking, Anita's, they don't have computers. But he, you know, he's doing this thing, you know, and the whole thing. And then he tells me the price. When he tells me the price, I'm looking at what Patty had written on there, and that's not lining up. I'm thinking, well, maybe the prices have changed and everything. So we put in the order. Well, a few days later, it hits me. I don't think I was talking to the people at Anita's. I was talking to the people at Joe's Cafe. And Joe's Cafe, their burritos are like this big. So if you order 30 of those bad boys, we'd be feeding McLean Bible Church's staff, you know. And so thankfully, you know, it hits me that we did it. So I call Joe's Cafe. I get one of the hosts there. I said, look, my name is Paul Goodnight. I put in this order. I want to cancel that order. And she says, I will, as soon as I hang up, I will tell one of the managers. Great. So I then call Anita's, I put in my order, Tuesday morning, I get there early, I pick it up, I get it over here, get it all set up, and I'm sitting in my office and my phone rings. Mr. Goodnight, we have your order. It was Chick-fil-A. I had never, there's somebody over at Joe's Cafe, well, who's this idiot, Paul Goodnight, calling us, like, you know. And so I'm in my office. There's not enough time to even go get this. Staff meeting is getting ready to start. And so we made this agreement for them to just hand them out at the drive-thru for the people going through. And I told them I would pay for it later. Why do I tell you that story? To remove all doubt that I'm a dope. No. Again, no one likes to look foolish. Nobody ever says, you know, my life's goal is to be a moron. I mean, anybody who'd say that, you'd feel pretty confident they're well on their way, right? But let me tell you the one person more than anybody else I did not want to tell. Melissa. Not because she would react wrongly, not because of anything she would do. It's because I did not want her to once again recognize what both of us know. I'm flawed. But the fact that Melissa does accept me and the fact that I can be me, I can tell her that we fed people at the drive-thru at Chick-fil-A. Isn't that swell? Yeah. James 3:2, again, it's not there to give me some pass. Like, I am flawed, you just got to put up with me. But it's a recognition of the obvious. That we're all flawed in many ways. And again, relationally, if I will let you know I accept you with your flaws and I want the real you, then our relationship is deep. But if I feel like that, I feel like I'm not accepted, you will not get all of me. And so choose to accept each other's flaws. The next one is this. I will seek and give forgiveness. I will seek and give forgiveness. I beg you to keep short accounts with each other and to live out forgiveness. Most people have been raised to say, I'm sorry, but few understand the power of forgiveness. The home in which I grew up, I had four siblings, and the whole idea of forgiveness, that never even came on our radar. Now, you know, with my brothers, we were, you know, if something, you know, major happened, we were told to say, I'm sorry. And we would give this really heartfelt sorry. Like, you know, sorry, you're bleeding on my stuff. It didn't mean anything, you know. And so I just grew up never even understanding that should be a value to really seek towards something way beyond sorry. When I was a younger man, though, I traveled with a gospel quartet. And I was traveling all around America in a 29-foot motorhome, and we had the guys in the quartet. One of the guys was a guy named Jack, and Jack was married. So his wife and three daughters traveled with us, a 6, 4, and 2-year-old, all of us in a 29-foot motorhome. It was a zoo on the road, but it made me desperately want daughters as a result of that. Well, I remember one weekend we're off the road and two of us are over at Jack's house and we're having a conversation with Jack. And while we're talking, his oldest daughter, Missy, comes into the room. She does something. I don't even know what she did, but Jack says something really sharp to her, very pointed, and then tells her to leave. And so she does. We keep talking, and then Jack goes, hang on a second. And he leaves. And then he comes back into the room with his daughter, Missy, and in front of me and this other guy, he gets down on one knee and starts talking to his daughter, confessing to her how wrong he was with what he had just done. And I was like, I didn't even know what to do. It was embarrassing. I'm watching humility like I've never seen before. And he's naming to her exactly what he did. And then he said, Missy, will you forgive me? And the first thing she did after she said, I forgive you, was to throw her arms around her dad and hug him. I walked away from that thinking, if I ever have children, I want to be like that. That kind of humility. Then Jack gets up and apologizes to me and this other guy about the way he handled his daughter. And then my mind blew up, like I've never known anybody this humble, you know. And Jack later on mentored me before I got married and talked about the idea of forgiveness. That saying you're sorry is not a bad thing, but it rarely closes the deal. If there's an offense and I come to you and I tell you exactly what I did and then I say to you, will you forgive me? Something has to happen. Forgiveness, you have to either grant it or not grant it. And if you don't grant it, you now own it because I did the right thing. But forgiveness is the only way that we're reconciled. And it gives us the opportunity to live out what's in Colossians 3:13, where it says, bearing with one another, forgiving one another. If anyone have a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. The standard for forgiveness is not whether someone's deserving of my forgiveness. The standard for forgiveness is the fact that Christ forgave us. Our debt was so big we could have never paid for it, and he chose to pay for all of it and forgive us every sin we've ever committed and ever will commit. And because of that standard of forgiveness, it only makes sense that I then would forgive others. And when you choose to keep short accounts in your marriage, it's amazing what it does. But couples who do not do that, and I describe this often in marriage counseling. If I take an arrow from you, I now deem you unsafe. And I will put up some kind of wall between you and me. If you ask for forgiveness, that arrow goes away and I take away the wall. If that does not happen, I leave it there. And now you can come to here, but you can no longer come to here because you hurt me and that's unresolved. If it happens again, I'll just move the wall out further and further and further. And our relationship will just look like we coexist. Forgiveness is the only way that goes away. And I implore you to keep short accounts in that. The last one. I will let God work through me. One of the great mysteries in the Christian life is discerning how much is dependent upon me for obedience and how much is dependent upon God. And the answer to that is both and. Look at Colossians 1:28 and 29. It says this, Him we preach, warning every man and teaching every man in all wisdom that we may present every man perfect in Christ Jesus. To this end I also labor, striving according to His working which works in me mightily. I strive, I labor, He works in me mightily. Philippians 2:13 says this, For it is God who works both to will and to do for His good pleasure. That His strength is happening in me, but I'm also enacting my will in obedience. It's a both and. Major Ian Thomas, who wrote the great book, The Saving Life of Christ, spoke here on a number of occasions, and he used to say, it's not inactivity, it's God's activity. It's understanding the truth of John 15:5, where he says, without me, you can do nothing. And so any of the things we've talked about, the idea of protecting your marriage or loving or your spouse's flawed, all those things, if I'm trying to do that with my own will, my own way, and God outside of the picture, I will only do it for so long, but I won't sustain it. But if I invite God to say, I want your will, I want you to work through me, to will and to do of your good pleasure, then now the fruit that comes from that is honoring to Him, and it's lasting. And so I'm going to encourage you, choose to love. Choose to protect your marriage. Choose to accept that your spouse is flawed. Choose to seek and give forgiveness. And choose to allow God to work through you to accomplish any of it. Okay, said all I know. Thank you.